case 13 from the gateless barrier. Doksan holds his bowls. One day Doksan went down toward the dining room holding his bowls. Seppo met him and asked, "Where are you off to with your bowls?" "The bell has not rung and the drum has not sounded." Doksan turned and went back to his room. Seppo mentioned this to Ganto, who remarked, "Doksan is renowned, but he does not know the last word." Doksan heard about this remark and sent his attendant to fetch Ganto. "You do not approve of me?" he asked Ganto. Ganto whispered his meaning. Doksan said nothing at the time, but next day he ascended the rostrum and behold, he was very different from usual. Ganto, going toward the front of the hall, clapped his hands and laughed loudly, saying, "Congratulations, our old man has got hold of the last word. From now on, nobody in this whole country can check him." Mumon's comment: "As for the last word, neither Ganto nor Doksan has ever dreamed of it. When you look into the matter, you find they are like puppets on the shelf." Mumon's verse: "If you realize the first, you master the last. The first and last are not one word." Already the last day of our training period, and first day and last day of the training period. Are they the same for you, or are they different? Gone by very retreat. Move into it, and starts off with a certain timeless slow, almost slow, not timeless in the big timeless, but sometimes timeless in the small sense of timeless. Starts off in that way, and sometimes in the beginning when we're settling in, finding our spot, circle around our cushion and sit down and put down our luggage and take off our blinders, and sometimes can't wait for the round to be over with the busyness and the restlessness of your life, my life, all of our lives, and wherever we're coming from, and then we begin to settle in. Sometimes the first word is, I hope he rings the bell pretty quick, because I'm in some serious trouble over here. And then, and that is the first word and the last word, since the last word is just the suchness of this moment. We are all bodhisattva practitioners, and we are all fearless bodhisattva practitioners trying to step into and to deeply appreciate this moment. This fleeting moment, this aliveness of the present tense as the last word, or as the last word in the sense that you really can't say anything more about it than what it is. So sometimes the first word in the beginning for me is a sense of impatience or anxiety, or gee, I hope this works out, or I hope everybody has a good retreat, or you know, all of the concerns that you may have or that I may have, and then we settle into the trail ride a little bit more, and the horses settle down, and we get into the belly of the retreat or the middle of the retreat. And I find often in these retreats that there are times during the sitting that I don't want the bell to ring, that I'm in a place of great spaciousness, or great openness, or great love, or some place that is a loving and fulfilled place, and I want to hold on to it and keep it. When I feel it slipping out of my grasp, and I'm hoping that the bell has not yet been rung, and then when I glance down at my watch, rather than glancing and saying, "Oh my God, 3 more minutes, how am I going to make it? My legs are killing me, my varicose veins are killing me, come on David, bring the freaking bell with you." Then I look at my watch and I say, oh, how can I stretch this out a little bit? Maybe I can make it last a little bit longer. It's so wonderful, I don't want this to stop. course, whether I like it or I don't like it or I'm indifferent, the bell rings every half an hour anyway. And I get up and I go for a walk in the garden. And then I find towards the end of the retreat that there is for me this curious mixture of, on the one hand, horses now are smelling the barn, and that's the clubhouse term of the ride, or the towards the end of the trail ride, and the horses are both. There's a kind of, it's an interesting thing, is for me, I feel this quite deeply in these retreats at this time, that there is both a restlessness, my horse is restless, wants to get to the barn, looking forward to going canoeing, whatever we're looking forward to or not. And the horse is both restless and excited, and also has the longing to return to the stable, to the barn. It's a kind of restlessness to go nowhere, or a kind of restlessness to return to the original dwelling place. So we are on this trail ride we call Sesshin, or we call our life, and so many, there are worlds within worlds in our training period, and dreams within dreams within dreams. You know, we're in a sense having a dream of Sesshin within the dream of our life. I suppose the wonderful thing about dreams, especially since we chant the dream gatha that the Buddha talked about, is that within a dream, on the one hand, in the dreams that I dream, I'm sure it's similar for you, sometimes I dream my dreams and I'm totally in that world of my dream, and my dream world has no, it's quite alive and vivid and all kinds of, I have all kinds of incredible adventures. I have a life, actually, I have a dream life that's a third of my hours of life, and that dream life is quite separate from my waking life, but from the perspective of my dreams, my waking life is just a dream. And from the perspective of my dream life, I often have no recollection of my waking life, of the vividness of my days, of the bright sun or cloudy days or leaves flying in the wind as they are now, a wonderful fall day of leaves flying in the wind. I have no recollection, but assuredly, at the end of my dream, even though from the dream perspective that dream is actually a whole life and worlds within worlds, and I suspect in the dream world, in the alaya consciousness and deep in the unconscious, that there is a certain continuity of dreams and a certain reality of dreams and a certain reality of the adventures of my dream selves coming and going and flying through the air as I do sometimes, or being terrified by monsters, or endlessly falling off the same cliff, or my father. My father was a professor at the Yale Law School, and had a number of quite wonderful conversations with him when he was at the end of his trail ride, and he talked about how he had the same dream all his life. Even after he retired, he would have it on a regular basis that he was unprepared for class. He would have this dream when he was in his 80s, and he died in his mid 80s. But he would have these dreams that he'd come to the law school and he was unprepared, and he appeared in front of his colleagues and his law students unprepared and a bad dog for not having done his homework. With his tail between his legs and feeling that kind of crinkly feeling of shame like cellophane and fire. He said, wow, it's quite a thing. Here I am at 84 years old. I'm dreaming I'm not prepared for law school. I found that, I didn't find it sad. I found it incredibly touching. And I found it touching because we are all unprepared for what we must do, and we're prepared wonderfully, and also unprepared. We're unprepared in the sense that that the past cannot help us, to a certain extent, meet the challenges of the moment, And yet we are wonderfully equipped to manifest as this moment because we are nothing but the aliveness. We are nothing but the body of the Buddha. We are nothing but the manifestation of this incredible self-nature, this this incredible intelligence and love that endlessly manifests, shapeshifts, creates itself, hides itself in itself, comes forward again. And there is no one outside of this activity of Dharma, this activity of Engi, this activity of the of Paticca Samuppada, the one who appears and disappears just like this. So when we study koan or we share the vignettes of our life, of our dreams, or our dream within our dream, or the dream of our life, or the dreams within the dream of our life, always I think there is this opportunity and this possibility for us to see it as the manifestation of what it is, which is the endless resourcefulness of life, and or to fixate our position and imagine that we are fixated here and that things are passing us by, or that things are pushing us forward, or that things are ignoring us and just leaving us in the wayside, you know, like abandoned and unseen and unappreciated. And of course, from the perspective of the I am self, and from the perspective of the discriminating consciousness, this is the first noble truth, that there is suffering, and suffering comes from alienation and isolation from life. And when we say alienation and isolation from life, we don't mean isolation from life as opposed to death. We mean isolation from that wonderful, bright, a mottled light that we experience when we walk in the garden on a sunny day, the light and shadow flickering, that's incredibly rich and luminous and beautiful. We step out into it and we realize that that inexpressible beauty, that sense of great meaning of our life that we can't even think about because it's so touching, or that sense of balance or perspective or whatever it is that we touch to in terms of a meaning or a truth or a beauty that is beyond conception, that is true because there isn't anything else and we don't need to be told, oh, this is a beautiful moment. If we're told this is a beautiful moment, it actually takes away from the immense beauty of the moment. So we don't need to be told that, do we? But the first noble truth and the cause of suffering is our fixation and our, as it says so wonderfully in the Diamond Sutra, is our attachment to a fixed point of view or a fixed self. And then we imagine that life is pushing us forward into something perhaps we don't want, or is leaving us behind, or is totally ignoring us, and everyone else is at the party having a grand time and we're outside appearing through the window trying to get in, or wondering whatever it is that we wonder. The Buddha was very, very clear about this, and we've been studying Dokusan's opening to his Dharma life, which was this entry into the Diamond Sutra. And I don't know about you, but for me this sutra, I go in and out. Sometimes it seems like reading the Yellow Pages or some kind of Latin thing. You know, I used to study Latin when I was a kid, and they always said, well, it's good for you, and when you grow up, you'll appreciate it. So, I don't know. I said, you know, those kind of things made a certain sense to me then. I thought these older people were somehow born wise, and they knew better than me, and they never were young like me. They came from a different planet, so they must know something that I don't know. I probably ought to study Latin, even though I never really liked it. Very much, but they said when I grew up, it would help me, and everything would make a certain kind of incredible sense if I just studied it and so forth and so on. But that's I could go. I'll try not to go off on that tangent right now. That would be a story. But clearly, this what happens that we go in and out of it, and here on the in our zazen, we go in and out of a space of separation from our life, and a sense of a lost, a stranger in a strange land, and lostness and a panic often, that differentiation, we could say, in a certain way. And of course, wonderful thing about the language of koans is that they are, it is so ironic and so, you can look at it from both sides. You know, Rinzai at the end of his life said, who would have thought, Rinzai, one of the great lights that has inspired all of us, we come from root teacher Sansanima's Rinzai lineage, and Rinzai was the founder of this way of life and practice, dynamic kind of Zen with lots of doubt. And Rinzai said at the end of his life, who would have thought after all of these years of 40, 50, 60 years of Sazen, I'd become a complete idiot. And when we hear words like this, or who would have thought I would, my Dharma heir would be a blind donkey like David. Although he does neigh pretty good, doesn't he? So we can appreciate these Dharma sayings as the sayings of our life, and we can really appreciate them from multiple angles. We can appreciate them from the side of good versus bad, right versus wrong, and then they are can cause a certain amount of pain, because we're either on one side or the other, and you can't be on both from that perspective. So either I'm a blind donkey who can't even neigh right and a complete idiot, or I'm one of those smooth guys with the varsity leather jackets, you know, the thing with the beautiful girl and the, you know, the Corvette and all, whatever the fantasy is. Or if I'm one of those as opposed to one of the geeks, you know, then I'm afraid that I might get contaminated by geekdom if I get to, you know how that goes back and forth. But there's another way of really appreciating this, since we are all of the faces of life all of the time, morphing and shape-shifting. We can really see it from this perspective of the movement of our entire life, that we spend times as the varsity letter holder, or the cheerleader, or the valedictorian, and we spend time as the geek and the dork and all of these faces. And when you start to see your life in this way, the many flashings of our life, and all of the joys, the 10,000 joys and sorrows, then there is the possibility for each one of these flashings to be a window into something quite wonderfully and beautiful and extraordinary. And similarly, when we isolate ourselves, fixate and judge and think that we are separate from the life of all worlds, then we fixate ourselves in a lonely position that we either have to defend, or afraid of losing, or deny that something, or get aggressive, or, you know, the strategies that we employ. So I love the language of Zen, because it is it shapeshifts all of the time, and we can experience the koan of our life from both the particular and the universal perspective. And that particularness, or that up-close taste and texture of and grain and aroma of our life in its particularness, right? The smell of the rice, or the sharp bite of my loneliness, or this morning, as David was talking, this field of benefaction and love and light that I started to step into. All of these stations of our life in the arc, and the myriad arcs along the arc of our life, are manifestations of something. And then there is a kind of wonderful, there can be a kind of wonderful appreciation of them. Or they can be places where we're stuck and we're caught, and we imagine that it's a one-time event, and I hope I get through it because I never want to do this again, that particular piece, or whatever, you know how it goes. So we are on this, we are in a way circumambulating the stupa of ourselves on the trail ride around, here we are on this journey, in this wonderful dream journey. I often when I get caught on one side of the koan, you know, when I get caught in the particular and lose the space within which that particle is taking place. The Buddha actually was very, very, if you read his talks about Pratitya Samuppada, the middle way teaching, which is the core teaching, it's not exactly the middle way between two opposites, although sometimes it's helpful to think of that, of the balance between openness of vipassana and concentration and groundedness, and the balance between these two and so forth. But actually, the balance place, if we use that metaphor, space particle or openness and concentration, the balance place is not, clearly is not a wonderful teaching of this. Is clearly it's not a fixed position, but it's a movement, a movement that is quite alive. And that in that movement or in that appreciation, there is the field in which it takes place, which is clearly limitless. No, as it says in the sutra, can you measure the distance to the east, Sabuti? Can you measure the distance to the west, Sabuti? Can you measure the distance up or below? No, Sabuti. Of course, we can't. We cannot measure this life. And yet, clearly, within the context of this life, when we see that this life is no life, but this no life is a full life, full of particulars, then the particular smells what he says, are the attribute that we can touch to and know the life of all worlds in the form of this smell or these wonderful now. Walking today, it's a rainy, cloudy day, and the leaves are flying outside. And I go out on this fall day with the leaves flying, and a certain wonderful experience of the fadeaway world, the falling away world, the other end of the arc of the leaves falling into the earth, or the fadeaway world. Not as something that is, I will fade away and everyone else will be left here having a party and I'll just be left out, but that everything is engaged in this, there is nothing outside of this movement. When I experience it that way myself, walking in this wonderful garden with the leaves flying, And I see that the leaves are flying, and the Tathagata is manifesting the one who is hiding herself, himself in emptiness. And of course, when we say hiding himself, herself in emptiness, we all have an idea about emptiness. So maybe it's not such a good word, but I suppose we have an idea about fullness, or we have an idea about love, or we have an idea about heaven, or we have an idea about God, but in the Buddhist tradition, we don't see God or heaven or reality or truth as a fixed position. We see it as a dynamic thing that is continually doing, engaging in this activity we call impermanence or transiency. Not impermanence in a flat way, but impermanence in a lively, wonderfully lively way. Then when I watch those leaves flying, and it's the same place, it's very close, you know, to, you know, the First Noble Truth and the cause of the Noble Truth and the cessation of suffering and the freedom of the way, which is what we're studying. Then the leaves flying, I reflect to myself, and actually in Zen, contemplation and thinking is a crucial aspect of our practice. And a very, very important one, and it gets a short shrift. In other words, it's very, very important to hone your poetic mind or your contemplative mind. And when we say contemplative mind, that kind of deep thought of no thought is different from just the rush of and mania of and hysteria of, you know, chicharrero mind of, you know, coming and going. But it's a much deeper, quieter kind of a deep contemplative thought, thinking the thought of no thought, or a kind of reflection where your, we say kanas, and your cognition and your reflection upon the nature of it and the experience of the moment flow one into the other. And then the word or one's investment in the word, or one's investment in the word, I don't mean investment in the sense of one's opinion about your thoughts, but one's seeing that one's contemplation about the nature of reality and Dharma contemplation is interfused and completely intermingled with the reality, since thought is nothing but the manifestation as well. Right? I remember Roshi telling me once during Rahatsu, I'm going to sit with him in Rahatsu later this month, so we'll be doing this, but we get up at 2:30 and go until 9:30 every day and see him four times. He's 104. And we see him four times a day. And then he sees 40 of us four times a day, and then he gives an hour lecture. And he's 104. And he can't walk anymore, or barely walk. They wheel him around in a wheelchair. And he comes in, you know, I sometimes see him in the Dharma hall before, walk around before we go in for Taisho. You know, they wheel him in and he's there. And he's a very, very old man, 104, and he sits in his wheelchair. He looks like the people I used to visit in the old folks' home when I visited my mother in her last days. And he kind of, you see his face is very tired, and there's a little drool coming out of his end of his mouth, and his nose is running, and his little white socks are there, and he's there in his robe and his ceremonial roxy. He looks like a little baby god of little prune. And you walk in, and the bell is rung, and we chant for Taisho, and suddenly the room is filled with light and love and intelligence, and it just, we weep. We weep the same way that we shed a tear when we walk into this bright, beautiful garden. And after we've been sitting strong and hard in here, and we walk out into the beauty of it all. So sometimes we imagine that we're separate from it, and I suppose we refresh ourselves in some way, and then we realize, or I have the contemplation. Roshi would say to me, you know, I would come in, he'd laugh, I'd come in and see him, you know. He said, if you want to, there's only one way to come and meet me, that's full bore. So you can't go in and chat with him. You don't do that no more. You know, you go into a furnace of light and brightness, you know, and the price to get in there is, he either kills you or you kill yourself before you go in, because there ain't no way you're not going to come in with all that crap. You know, but anyway, he'll see me, I'll be coming in, I'll come on and do my prostrations, and I am so happy to see him. I revere and love this man as much as my breath. I have never known such love in my life, knew it was possible, so I'm extremely happy to see him, and I'm happy for whatever he says to me, most of the time. I mean, sometimes I get fixated and, you know, dirty, stupid old man, what does he know, or sort of like in the koan, but more often than not, I'm happy to be insulted, I'm happy to be loved, I'm happy to be disregarded, I'm just happy the guy's around. You know, I can come in and if he's sitting there sleeping or snoring, sometimes I come in and he's tired and he's asleep, you know, I mean, he's 100 people out and he's kind of nodding off, and I'll go, oh, Roshi, and he kind of, and then he wakes up and looks at me, smells good. So, oh, Roshi, he says, Roshi's awake now. I'm happy to see him. I'm happy when he insults me, because I just glow, and I'm happy when he falls asleep when I'm there, because it means that he feels relaxed enough around me not to give a shit, and I'm just family, and I'm happy when he holds my hand, and we just sit there in silence and hold hands. And dwell in the body of love. But anyway, he comes in, he says, oh, you again, the guilty Christian, here you are. I feel guilty about everything. I don't know. That's one of my life koans. You know, I figure if there's a mistake, I must have something to do with it. I must have done it. Or it's such narcissism, isn't it? You know, like best, worst, all of it. But he's a guilty Christian. And then another time, you know, it's said with such love and with such authenticity that it's a turning word, you know. I don't know, and it finds its way into me, and I use it well. I don't even know what he's thinking when he says it, you know. Maybe he's thinking, God, this guy again. But I take it, because it's coming in the context of the Dharma Kaya body, I take it as a revelation, as a truth, and I use it and go away. And then I come back again. And he looked at me. And he said one time, he said, you know, he said, if you really got where your thoughts come from, you wouldn't worry so much about thinking anymore. Anyway. So I was out walking, watching the leaves blow, and thinking, I'm feeling kind of sad. About all the, and that kind of nostalgic, sad feeling. And then I was contemplating fall, and contemplating, gee, leaves are falling, and we're all falling by the wayside, you know, appearing and disappearing in these arcs of life and the arcs of our life. And I was reflecting, you know, there isn't anyone or anything or any space born of water or air, or born with perception or no perception, or born with or no perception. There is nothing that can be conceived of or imagined, or nothing that cannot be imagined, that is not a part of this activity of life. And if there were something apart from this activity of life, it would be a lonely, disturbing life, because you would be the one person left out of the party, out of love and reality. You would be the one particle in this vast cosmos that was left out. When I see it that way, and I see the cause of suffering, which is alienation and separation and fixation and all of that, then I say quietly to myself, oh, I better abandon that world, because I want to be one with the flying leaves, because everything that I have ever known or will ever know is right here in this world, and I'm going to.